Hit subscribe now to get new episodes as soon as they're released.
It's midday, time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest is the writer Peter J. Conradi.
Back when he was studying English at UEA, Peter J. Conradi had a friend who ran the Student Literary Society, organising writers to come to Norwich and speak. He went along to a meeting, and the speaker there changed the whole course of his life. The writer was Iris Murdoch. She became a friend, and he became, in his words, her disciple, and eventually her biographer. And then Peter and his partner, Jim O'Neill, spent 8 months caring for Iris at the end of her life, as Alzheimer's took hold. They listened to a lot of music together, as we'll hear. Peter spent his career as an English professor at Kingston University, and his biography of Iris is by no means his only book. He's also written about Dostoevsky, John Fowles, and Angus Wilson, about grief, about becoming a Buddhist, and about dogs, a subject dear to my heart, as you know, Peter. In your book about dogs, you say that if you had to choose between dogs and music, you'd probably choose dogs. But having said that, music does come a close second, doesn't it?
It does, and with luck, no one's going to make us choose between the two this lifetime.
No, well, we won't show you the door yet, because you've chosen today a playlist which includes Bach, Leonard Cohen, Strauss and Schubert. But we're going to start with Benjamin Britten and his War Requiem. You heard this at the Proms in 1963, just a year after it was written, and I think it was a very powerful experience.
Yes, indeed. It was electrifying. I just left school, and I went with my school friend Harry Dickinson, and we'd never been to the Albert Hall, we'd never been to the Proms. We sat up in the gods, and it was an electrifying event. There was a quality of stillness and expectation. There was a sense of being present at the birth of a masterpiece, of a work of absolute genius. That was how we felt.
What did you make of the marrying of the Latin Mass and the Wilfred Owen poems?
It was a brilliant move on Britain's part, because after all, organised religion has been complicit in justifying so-called just wars. And you can't do that with the Latin Mass. It undercut a lot of tradition. And the combination, the movement between the two, was breathtaking.
This, of course, was just less than a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and so there was a real widespread fear.
Exactly. I think 2 years, but you're perfectly right. It was, this came at the, we feared apocalypse, certainly.
So that added to the emotional thrust of the whole event.
It did, yes, and it was completely wonderful.
We're going to hear the final section of the War Requiem, setting Wilfred Owen's strange meeting, and then, of course, moving back into the traditional Latin text. I think you've asked for Britten's own recording from 1963.
Yes, indeed. There's a completely wonderful use of the tubular bells, a simple chord that comes in and picks up what passing bells for those who die as cattle. And it distills pure grief, and it's a masterstroke, it strikes me.
final section of Benjamin Britten's War Requiem, we heard the soloists Glina Vishnevskaya, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, and Peter Pears in that recording from 1963, with the composer himself conducting the London Symphony Orchestra, Melos Ensemble, Bach Choir, and the Highgate School Choir. Well, from one finale, Peter, to another, because this is the famous finale from Der Rosenkavalier. It's one of the most haunting sections of any opera, especially after the rather labyrinthine goings-on to get there. A scene of renunciation, where the older woman renounces her claim on a young lover, giving way to a younger woman. So it's a kind of also quite an interesting philosophical thing, isn't it? We're, you know, actually coming to terms with something and facing it.
Yes, exactly. I chose this partly because, of course, it's wonderful, but also because it forms an important plot device in Iris Murdoch's The Black Prince in 1973, where her hero narrator, on listening to these women's voices in Rosenkavalier, has to go out and vomit in the street. It's as if the power of music is literally visceral. It hits you below the belt. It hits you, as they say, in the gut. Yeah. But I think it is unique that music gets at you precognitively, as it were, before you've had time to think. It's very unfair.
Well, we're going to hear a live recording from the Opera House made in 1995 with great singers Anne Murray, Barbara Bonney and Anna Tomava Sintoff. Andrew Davis conducting the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, in the final trio from Der Rosenkavalier by Richard Strauss, with Anne Murray, Barbara Bonney, and Anna Tomova-Sintoff. I said at the beginning, Peter J. Conradi, that your meeting with Iris Murdoch really changed your life. You wrote your doctoral thesis on her work and then later became her biographer. You say you were also her disciple, so did she in a way cast a spell on you?
I think in some ways she did, yes. I used to feel with each novel that it was written about me in some sense, which is the sign of great writing. At the beginning, she alarmed me. She listened so attentively. She gave away so little. But she was scary in some ways. A Norwegian friend who'd fought both in the Winter War and against the Germans said it was much less alarming than sitting next to Iris Murdoch at dinner.
She, of course, cast her spell on many other people in her life. Men and women fell in love with her all the time. And she had a complex personal life, didn't she? She was secretive.
Yes, she was. And it's one thing I still struggle to understand. I can accommodate, I think we all can, the idea of being in love with two people. But the idea of being in love with 10...
Time-consuming.
Well, time-consuming and rather complex. And then writing a novel a year, too, at the same time.
And sexually ambidextrous.
Sexually ambidextrous, she was indeed. And she doesn't, in some ways, she doesn't distinguish between love and friendship.
Did you become embroiled in the kind of sexual manipulations of Iris?
No, I didn't. Very simple. Sorry. I felt that she was enormously attractive, but happily this complication didn't affect my work at all.
That's probably why you were so good as a biographer. If you'd been romantically involved with Iris, or even just sexually involved, that might have made it very difficult.
Yes, definitely. I'm sure you're right.
Well, you clearly think she is the great writer that she is now accepted to be.
I think so, and happily her reputation has survived the film and so forth.
Well, let me just pick you up on that. You thought the film wasn't very good.
Well, there's scarcely a single word she wrote in it, and very few that she ever said. And I overheard two ladies not long after, in front of a portrait of her, one was explaining to the other, that's the writer who went mad. Well, that's not how she should be remembered.
This was the film Iris.
Correct. Yeah.
And how was your relationship with Iris's husband, John Bailey?
It was excellent. He's buried in our garden. or rather, his ashes are.
Your love for Iris really lasted until her death. You and your partner, Jim O'Neill, became carers for her at the end of her life. And as well as making sure she got the swimming she loved, you listened to music together.
We did, all the time. And this is commonly observed. I'm by no means the first person to have seen this, but her musical memory outlasted her verbal memory. So she could sing and remember the words to songs till very, very late, and she could remember tunes when the words weren't there.
And dance.
And she could dance.
Yes.
And did, 6 weeks before she died, in fact.
Well, with Bartok next, music you discovered when you were still at school. This is a wonderful piece. I think it's a very underrated 20th century masterpiece, the Concerto for Orchestra. But what was it about the piece that you loved, and this section in particular?
Well, I was a rebellious teenager, and I liked composers who seemed to be breaking the mould, who seemed to be transgressing in some way. So I listened to a lot of Alban Berg and Schoenberg and Stravinsky in Britain, and this one section from Bartok, the entire orchestra appears to be dissolving into laughter with a glissandi on the woodwind, followed by an impolite noise.
A fart, let's not get...
let's not mince our words. Either on a bass trombone or a contrabass bassoon. And that fascinated me.
Thank you.
It's such a marvellous piece, and in that movement, we not only heard the lampooning, the fun, the waltz, but that wonderful tune, that folk tune, which clearly comes from Hungarian folk music.
Yes, it's lovely.
Susanna Melki conducting the Helsinki Philharmonic in the fourth movement of Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra, music you first heard, Peter Conradi, at school. Now, you've written about your childhood, and actually it sounds really unhappy. Your parents were at war with each other. You didn't have any relationship with your father until they divorced. And then as a young man, you began to experience panic attacks. And it was, I suppose, this unhappiness that possibly led you to Buddhism.
Yes, I wrote about it in a memoir called Family Business. I did have a relationship with my father, but it was combative. And my childhood wasn't so terrible, but panic attacks did arrive and got worse in my 20s.
I know you find the Buddhist approach to suffering very helpful.
Yes, the very first sermon the Buddha ever preached, the so-called fire sermon, the first noble truth is the truth of suffering, that suffering's unavoidable. It's part of the background music to life. I think hearing that is very helpful because the experience of many of us is that suffering cuts us off from others. The Buddhist approach is that suffering actually connects you with everybody else.
And you actually pass this on to people, don't you? Because you run courses with meditation.
That's true. I and my partner, Jim O'Neill, I think I've spent about 1 year in group retreat. It's very calming not having to listen to oneself or others.
I know that you love the music of Leonard Cohen?
Yes. Jim, who was a fellow Canadian, together with Leonard Cohen, introduced me to this wonderful song with this marvellous line, "There is a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets in."
He was a Zen monk, wasn't he?
For 5 years. Five brave years.
Well, let's hear this song with that immortal line.
The birds, they sing at the break of day. Start again, I heard them say. Don't dwell on what has passed away or what is yet to be. Yeah, the war, they will be fought again. The holy dove, she will be cut again. Bought and sold and bought again. The dove is never free. Thundercloud, they're gonna hear from me. but still could ring. You can add up the parts, you won't have the sum. You can strike up the march, there is no drum. Every heart to love will come, but like a refugee.
Leonard Cohen's anthem from his 1992 album, The Future. It was Jim, as you said, who introduced you to that, your Canadian partner, Jim O'Neill, and you've been together now for 45 years. When you first came out as a gay man, it wasn't easy. Homosexuality had only just been decriminalised, and there was still a sense of jeopardy.
Very much so. I got involved in co-editing the first gay magazine called Lunch Magazine before Gay News, in which we pioneered what is now commonplace coming out stories, and opposed the harassment and entrapment that the police were still exercising or operating despite the change in the law.
And did you feel at the time that you were taking on the entire establishment to try and change things?
Well, I wasn't the only person doing
it. No, I know. So,
yes, there was a sense. And looking back, it is surely marvellous and extraordinary and surprising that attitudes have so changed in a comparatively short time, that homosexuality has become unremarkable, ordinary.
And the gay marriage.
And gay marriage, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It seems that there always has to be somebody who's prepared to go a mile in order for society in general to achieve an inch.
I think that's right, yes.
Let's go to your next music, Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, because you saw this at a benefit for an HIV charity at Covent Garden, didn't you?
That's right. It was the first ever Covent Garden gala performance for AIDS, and it was set up in part by our friend Anthony Keith, the co-founder of Crusade, a leading HIV charity. Princess Di was the guest of honour. And there was a very moving echo between the event on stage and what was happening in the audience. Anthony died within a year, and many others died. And, of course, the stage is littered with young men, corpses.
Well, let's hear the final scene of Romeo and Juliet. Mark Oehmler directing the orchestra of the Royal Opera House in the final scene from Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. From the turbulence of that tragic scene, Peter, we're going to move to the serenity of Bach's first cello suite performed by Yo-Yo Ma. I think this takes you back to a time that you spent teaching English in Poland just after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yes, that's right. I got there in the summer of 1990 and I lived there for two wonderful years. And although Warsaw had begun to modernize, Kraków, where I was in the south, had not. There was nothing in the shops much. Even for booze, you had to go to a hard currency shop. There were Russian troops. It was a remarkable time, and I felt privileged to be able to experience it.
Actually, you've always been fascinated by Eastern Europe, and indeed your family were originally German-Jewish.
Absolutely right, yes.
And you took with you a small cassette player, a few cassettes, and this is one of the pieces you return to again and again?
Yes, that's right. I adore this piece. It strikes me that if there were a parallel universe, this is what we'd be playing. It's like listening to God thinking.
Prelude from the Cello Suite No. 1 in G Major by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Yo-Yo Ma on his 2018 recording. You spent most of your time now, Peter, in Wales, in what was the county of Radnorshire, indeed quite like to think of it still as being Radnorshire, a very beautiful landscape as I know well. You've written about the history and the culture of the Welsh marches. What is it that you think makes it so special?
Wow. It's underpopulated. I think there are 10 times as many sheep as human beings.
It's not on the way anywhere.
It's not on the way anywhere. It's very little known. It's been called Britain's best-kept secret. It's enchanting, I think.
And as you particularly love walking with Jim and your hound...
Yes.
Sheepdog.
Yes, exactly.
That beauty you are able to come to terms with very intimately.
Yes, that's right. And I initially bought it with my old history professor, the Gladstone biographer Richard Shannon, who continued my music education enormously. And this final piece is a piece that he introduced me to. I was probably the last person in the world to realize how wonderful it is. It's the Adagio by Schubert in C, the string quintet.
And this is a very famous recording, too. It's the 1952 version with Casals and Tortelier playing the extra cello.
Yes, it's just marvellous. And it's so astonishingly simple with the pizzicati in the background. And almost nothing happens and has a quality of immense pathos and resolution.
It is a piece that is synonymous with a lot of memorial services,
I can imagine.
Being melancholy, elegiac. But I think you've written a lot about grief and death, haven't you? And as a Buddhist, you must have a reasonably positive hope for life after death.
Well, I'm not sure that I do, particularly. You're perfectly right that reincarnation seems to be one of the required beliefs, but I can't make a lot of sense of it, to be honest. If we are reincarnated, why aren't Bono monkeys reincarnated?
You might come back as a dog.
Well, of course, that would be okay.
Well, Peter, that's a nice note to finish on what is otherwise a somewhat tragic but wonderful. I mean, isn't it interesting how the deeply tragic, as we heard in the Prokofiev, as we're going to hear now, is so life-enhancing, that actually it's cathartic, that we want to be moved beyond tears.
Very well said.
Well, Peter J. Conradi, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. Music from the Adagio of Schubert, String Quintet in C, in a recording from 1952, with cellist Pablo Casals, Paul Tortelier, violinists Isaac Stern and Alexander Schneider, and the viola player Milton Catins. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions this week, Peter J. Conradi. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. Private Passions returns next Sunday at noon when Michael's guest will be the lawyer and campaigner Helena Kennedy. Words and Music later celebrates the landscapes and wildlife of the British Isles to tie in with David Attenborough's new documentary series Wild Isles. Be transported around our Wild Isles this afternoon at 5:30. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock. Time for the news read by me, Emily Jeffrey. The BBC's football coverage is being disrupted for a second day as talks continue to try to resolve the row about Gary Lineker's tweets criticising the government's migration policy. Match of the day two and coverage of the Women's Super League will be much reduced and shown without presenters because of a boycott by colleagues supporting Gary Lineker. The Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, has said that the government can make a big difference on childcare costs in the budget on Wednesday. Measures designed to get more people into work will include paying the childcare costs of people on universal credit in advance, rather than making them claim the money back later. There'll also be support for disabled people and those with long-term health conditions. Labour said the UK was in a spiral of low growth and said more needed to be done to secure long-term investment in new industries. Jeremy Hunt also warned that British technology companies are at serious risk from the collapse of the UK arm of the Silicon Valley Bank, but he said the government was doing everything it could to minimise the damage to customers. Regulators in the US shut down SVB on Friday after the lender's financial troubles spurred investors to sell shares. The Israeli army says troops have shot dead three armed Palestinians during a reported exchange of gunfire in the occupied West Bank. It says a group of Palestinians had opened fire on soldiers at a military post near Nablus. There's been a surge in violence in the region in recent months. Rishi Sunak is flying to the United States for meetings with President Joe Biden and Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to flesh out a major defence deal. The Prime Minister will arrive in San Diego tonight to discuss Australia's procurement of nuclear-powered submarines under the AUKUS pact. The agreement was set up in 2021 and aims to counter the threat posed by China. Cricket and England's men have lost their three-match 2020 international series against Bangladesh after a four-wicket defeat in Mirpur gave the hosts an unassailable 2-0 lead. And the weather, rain pushing across Northern Ireland and southern Scotland, also into the southwest. Highs of 14 degrees in London, 12 in Manchester, 11 in Cardiff and Belfast. BBC News at 2 minutes past one.
August Strindberg's darkly humorous classic play about a toxic marriage.
We have to stock up for our silver wedding celebrations.
You really want to celebrate that?
Well, of course I do, don't you?
Things begin to unravel when a figure from their past returns.
Did Edgar have anything to do with me losing custody of my children?
Oh, Kurt, it's all so long ago.
Starring Robert Glenister and Hattie Morahan.
She's just angry because I didn't die last night.
No, I'm angry because...